Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. This week we present Hadas Tyr, an author and activist who talks about the failure of Congress to pass a desperately needed pandemic rescue package, while the Federal Reserve spends trillions, no questions asked. Kevin Martin, president of Peace Action, who assesses the recent unsuccessful effort in Congress to transfer 10% of the Pentagon budget to meet basic human need during the coronavirus health and economic crisis. And Roger Clark of the Grand Canyon Trust, who explains why the Navajo Nation and environmental groups oppose a planned dam project on the Little Colorado River Gorge adjacent to the Grand Canyon. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
In Darfur in western Sudan, dozens of Arab militiamen arrived on camels in mid-July and stormed into a remote African village. 9 people were killed, with another 20 wounded in the hamlet of Feto Bornu. Several weeks later, hundreds of Janjaweed militiamen killed 60 villagers. United Nations peacekeepers were unable to stop the carnage. Prior to the assault on Feto Bornu, villagers had led a protest demanding the resignation of the local governor. Suddenly, security was withdrawn from the village and the Janjaweed launched an attack the next day. Justice for Darfur remains elusive, even as a new reform-minded government has taken control of the nation, and Sudan's former authoritarian leader, Omar Hassan al-Bashir, sits in prison, convicted of corruption. The UN estimates 300,000 people have died in the long-running Darfur conflict. However, the international community's attention on Darfur is waning, with aid declining and the number of peacekeepers greatly reduced. After the imposition of a new security law in Hong Kong, Beijing has waged a fierce offensive on pro-democracy activists, including the cancellation of planned legislative elections, citing the territory's spike in coronavirus cases. Chinese security forces are seeking the arrest of 6 exiled Hong Kong activists, including Simon Cheung, a former employee of the United Kingdom's Hong Kong consulate, who claims he was beaten while in Chinese custody. Western nations, including Great Britain and the United Nations, have condemned the crackdown. Britain has offered asylum to pro-democracy activists, and the Trump administration imposed selective sanctions against top Hong Kong leaders, including Carrie Lam, the region's chief executive. Beijing dismissed the sanctions as blatant and barbaric. China's crackdown on the city has prompted many residents to consider emigrating. A poll by the Chinese University of Hong Kong, conducted after the announcement of the security law, found that half of 15 to 24-year-olds were considering leaving. The UK, the city's one-time colonial power, is permitting Hong Kong residents to live and work in Great Britain. While both Canada and Australia are also offering a pathway for residency for a price, Taiwan is the preferred destination for most Hong Kong families looking to relocate. With the expiration of the $600 supplemental federal unemployment benefits and the end of COVID-19 eviction protections, millions of tenants are facing the loss of their homes in the weeks ahead. While Congress is deadlocked over extending vital pandemic assistance, housing activists are reviving depression-era tactics to protect poor and working-class tenants from abusive landlords. Tenant activists in urban centers, now linked with the Black Lives Matter movement, are combining direct action campaigns to end police brutality and housing gentrification targeting communities of color. The Los Angeles Tenants Union reversed a lockout in May. In the Crown Heights section of Brooklyn, dozens of activists led by Equality for Flatbush stopped an illegal eviction of families after their landlord put their furniture on the street without a legal eviction notice. Activists confronted the landlord, who was accused of trying to remove current Black, queer, and transgender tenants and replace them with younger, wealthier white renters. While the activists' blockade of the building resulted in a temporary victory after months of harassment, it's likely to be a long, hot summer in the nationwide struggle to protect millions of tenants' rights to affordable housing. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Despite the expiration of enhanced $600 federal unemployment checks and the end of a moratorium on tenant evictions, Congress remains deadlocked on negotiating a coronavirus rescue package. While the Democratic House passed a $3.4 trillion pandemic stimulus bill in mid-May, the Republicans who control the U.S. Senate are unwilling or unable to negotiate desperately needed funding legislation. Into this void, President Trump launched a series of symbolic executive actions that give the appearance of a White House taking charge, but in reality will likely provide little or no help to ordinary Americans. While the Trump regime and Republicans fight to limit government spending in the next round of emergency COVID assistance, the Federal Reserve is deregulating the banking industry and spending $4 to $6 trillion to prop up financial markets by buying up corporate bonds. These trillions of dollars are being spent by the Fed without any public debate or oversight. Your reporter spoke with Hadas Tyar, an activist and author based in New York City, who talks about the failure of Congress to pass a pandemic rescue package and the trillions of dollars being spent by the Federal Reserve, no questions asked.
You know, we're at the precipice of a major housing crisis, of evictions and homelessness around the corner and all the rest of it. And in that context, the deadlock that's happening in D.C. right now is just infuriating. It's basically the whole stimulus package is being used as a political football and, you know, in an election year. It's absolutely infuriating and absurd that they haven't gotten further in all the time that they've had. And obviously, the lion's share of fault lies with the Republican Party because they, you know, they've had months to come up with a counteroffer to the Democrats' proposal, and they didn't, and they're refusing to budge on the major issues and on how much is allocated. But I think that the overall kind of theatrics that are being played out right now are coming at our expense.
Hadas, in your article, you wrote about the Federal Reserve and the literally trillions of dollars being pumped in to certain sectors of the economy. We often hear the saying that Wall Street is not the U.S. economy. But you have people like Donald Trump, who don't seem all too conversant in economics, looking at Wall Street as a barometer of the U.S. economy. And while we're at record unemployment, and certainly for many people across the country, in a very stressful situation with no job and no reliable source of income, the stock market is doing quite well. Tell us about the connection with the Federal Reserve and what they're up to.
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. And I think, you know, a lot of what's shady about that whole situation is that, A, it's completely undemocratic. I mean, all of these debates happening in Congress, for all their faults, they're out in the open. And the people that are debating this out are facing reelection prospects and have some semblance of accountability to somebody. The Federal Reserve is able to just essentially print out money. It's not physical money that they're printing, but they're creating money. They're pumping it into financial markets. There's zero oversight. You know, some of it is necessary. If we had a situation where the financial markets completely froze up and there wasn't credit flowing to businesses, you know, that would be a very big shock to the system and would be very destructive to regular people's lives in addition to those companies. But there's basically no strings attached to any of this stuff. They're now lending money, you know, putting money through banks into the financial markets, but they're actually lending money directly to corporations for the first time. That's something that's always been seen as the purview of Congress and the kind of fiscal spending that's built into the stimulus bills that are being debated. But right now, the Federal Reserve is kind of doing a runaround and is able to lend money directly to corporations. And part of what that means is that they can get away with doing things like bailing out the oil industry, whereas when it happens in Congress, again, there's a little bit more oversight and a little bit more transparency there. Not that that doesn't mean there isn't plenty of corporate slush funds that are being pumped in through the stimulus bills, because there are, and there was nearly $60 billion that went to the airline industry, which is an industry not known for particularly protecting its workforce. They're debating out in Congress right now $1 trillion versus $3.4 trillion. Democrats have already said that they were willing to go down to $2 trillion. The Republicans are saying that's absurd. But meanwhile, like the Federal Reserve, no one's debating these numbers. They've already said that they have, you know, $4 trillion allocated to these various facilities. Most estimates say that it's more like $6 trillion that's going to be spent, you know, in the pretty near future. That's huge sums of money, and that is money that actually could be going to certainly enhance unemployment benefits, but also very many other things that are desperately needed for states, hospitals, for vaccines, et cetera. It's money that's completely unaccountable.
Is there any move in Congress to attempt to hold the Federal Reserve accountable for what they're doing and to reprioritize those large numbers of dollars that are going to financial institutions right now?
I don't think so. I mean, I certainly haven't heard of anything like that. I think it would be a very good idea. I think, you know, one of the things that I mentioned in my article is that as a left in this country broadly, you know, that we need to pay a lot more attention to the Federal Reserve and we need to start making demands around it. I think right now there's a very small subsection of the left that really pays attention to what's happening with the Federal Reserve. And so there's a lot of attention being paid, and rightly so, to the question of extending unemployment benefits. You know, those are the things that are most immediately felt in our day-to-day lives. But we need to be able to have a little bit of a bigger picture about what the priorities are of our federal government in terms of how money is being allocated. And I think the Federal Reserve needs to be a key part of that. I think there needs to be a lot more of us kind of following and tracking what's happening and coming up with demands that we can then bring to our representatives to try to make movement on.
That was Hada Steer, an activist and author based in New York City. Find a link to her recent Jacobin magazine article, "Congress Has Failed to Extend Unemployment Benefits. We Need Them Desperately and Much More," by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Her forthcoming book titled A People's Guide to Capitalism, An Introduction to Marxist Economics, will be published in late August. An effort by progressive members of Congress to reduce the Pentagon budget by 10% to fund human need during the economic crisis created by the coronavirus pandemic failed in votes held in both the House and Senate in late July. The amendment to the National Defense Authorization Act was sponsored in the House by Democrats Barbara Lee of California and Mark Pocan of Wisconsin, and in the Senate by independent Bernie Sanders of Vermont and Democrat Ed Markey of Massachusetts. Sponsors of the legislation argued that redirecting $74 billion from the Pentagon to help Americans in need with health care, affordable housing, education, and local infrastructure would better align with people's actual priorities in this crisis, and that national security should be redefined in the wake of the global pandemic. A poll recently conducted by Data for Progress found that 56% of the country supported the idea of defunding the military and to use the money to fight COVID-19 and alleviate the growing housing crisis. The survey found that a majority of both Democrats and Republicans supported the proposal. Your reporter spoke with Kevin Martin, president of Peace Action and the Peace Action Education Fund, who assesses the effort to redirect Pentagon funds to human needs and next steps in the campaign to challenge the growth in military spending, which has increased by 20% under the Trump regime.
Well, we really appreciated Senator Sanders putting that out, and we worked with his staff to do it, and then also on the House side, too, some of the progressive leaders. Now, the thing is, you know, the bizarro world of Washington, where I live, this 10% cut in the gargantuan Pentagon budget is both, on the one hand, completely insufficient for what we need and what we've needed for a long time. That 10% cut, we need to go well beyond that. And especially the way that Sanders and his supporters framed it was to address the COVID crisis and deal with particularly people that are in dire poverty or have lost their jobs or their health care or their housing from the pandemic. And to take that $74 billion, that would have been 10%, which is, you know, that's the you know, pocket change. That's paperclip money for the Pentagon, right? Take that and put that to work to help actual people deal with the real threats to their lives, not wasting it on the useless, you know, weapons that we'll never use and don't need. And if we do use them, it's to kill black and brown people in other countries, not to defend our freedoms or any of that other garbage that they talk about, right? So on the one hand, it's completely insufficient and also completely not viable politically in Washington. And, you know, I understand that, and certainly people that have looked at this for a long time understand that, but that's the reality of life in an imploding superpower, you know, an expiring empire. We're going to probably hold on to every nickel of that Pentagon budget until the whole country implodes. You know, that's just the power of the military-industrial complex, unless we, the people, say, no, that can't be. Those can't be the priorities. That can't be how you spend our tax dollars. We need it to address the real security needs in our communities and our households, not whatever, starting a new arms race with Russia or China, whatever nonsense the military-industrial complex is coming up with. And, you know, unless we do that soon and link up with other powerful movements, this is going to be our reality. We're an imploding superpower, and we're going to hang on to all our weapons as long as we possibly can until people say, no, we're not going to tolerate that anymore.
And as you said, the coronavirus pandemic and the ensuing economic collapse here really paints in very stark relief the mismatch priorities of the government here. While we're seeing austerity and a package of just, you know, moderate stimulus for people who've been out of work, record numbers of people on the street with no job during this health crisis.
And, you know, this stimulus package you're talking about, it'll help some people for a couple weeks, and that's about it. And then what? They could be out on the street or hungry. I mean, it's just, you know. And so this is unfortunately what we are dealing with in this country, is just the war machine on autopilot. It just runs on autopilot. There's no thought that goes into it. There's no real discussion of, do we need this new weapon system, this new airplane that we need it because we sold the other airplane to eight other countries, and now we need a better airplane to defeat them, and we're never going to have a war with them in the first place, right? It's just lunacy, but that's what happens. It's just the war machine on autopilot.
Well, thank you for that, Kevin. What's the next step in this campaign? It's not ending, of course.
No, and as I said, I appreciate Senator Sanders and some of his other allies in terms of throwing this out there as a marker. And I think a lot of what's going on in Congress right now, especially when we know we can pass good things in the House, Sanders has been a great leader on trying to stop U.S. support for the horrific Saudi-led war in Yemen. We were able to pass that twice in both the House and the Senate, and of course it was vetoed by Trump, and they weren't able to override the veto. So there are a lot of things that we can pass in the House and sometimes in the Senate too, and we know they're not going to go, you know, any further with Trump in the White House. So some of these things are putting down markers for the future, what we could do next year legislatively. I don't think Biden is pro-peace or, you know, progressive or anything like that, although he does have some decent track record on some issues of diplomacy and arms control and et cetera. But if you have a new administration and a stronger progressive Congress, which we think we will, we might be able to go further. So in some ways, it was a little premature of Bernie to throw this out there, but I'm glad he did. It was worth putting it out there to say, hey, let's cut the Pentagon budget, because it's the sacred cow, right? You can't talk about cutting the Pentagon budget. You're against America, against our defense. You're a commie, whatever other garbage is hurled at you if you dare, you know, suggest that there's a better way to spend our tax dollars than useless weapons and, you know, starting arms races, right? That we could possibly take care of the common good of people, right? So it was good that it was out there. And I suspect we won't have another vote this year, but There may be some cuts when we get to the defense appropriations. We can look at cutting specific weapon systems that are particularly worthless. Look at cutting back on some of the nuclear weapons modernization, some of the F-35s and other just, you know, garbage like Star Wars missile defense, et cetera. We probably won't win on those again, but again, it's good to get members of Congress on record, hold them accountable, and then see what we're able to do next year when we're in better shape. But there's no reason to think we're going to have a massive cut in the Pentagon budget next year either. This is obviously a long-term issue. The urgency that I think ought to be imparted is because of the pandemic, but, you know, Peace Action and our supporters have been for cutting the Pentagon budget for a long, long time, obviously.
That was Kevin Martin, president of Peace Action and the Peace Action Education Fund. Learn more about the campaign to challenge the record growth in U.S. military spending by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The Grand Canyon ecosystem is more than just Grand Canyon National Park, and developers are now hoping to build three dams on a tributary of the Colorado River, just east of the Grand Canyon. The proposed dams would be part of a pumped hydro storage project to store electricity when it's in surplus, to be used when renewable energy is not available. The latest proposal for Big Canyon would dam a side canyon of the Little Colorado River, about 10 miles from Grand Canyon National Park, entirely on Navajo Nation land. The application to conduct feasibility studies was accepted in June by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, but FERC must provide additional approvals if the project is to be built. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Roger Clark, Grand Canyon Program Director with the Grand Canyon Trust, about the dangers the project poses to endangered species, the cultural heritage of indigenous nations, and the scarce water supply in the region that will be even more stressed by the planet's accelerating climate crisis.
The project itself would store about 44,000 acre feet, 44,000 football fields, a foot deep. A football field's about an acre, so imagine football field with 1 foot on it. Well, this would be 44,000 acre feet of water in the lower reservoir. And then there would be three upper reservoirs that would contain water for storage and producing electricity. The water for this side canyon project would come not from water flowing down the canyon, although it floods seasonally from time to time. The water would come from groundwater. And the developer's proposing to put three wells in the bottom of the canyon floor and then pump all that groundwater into the storage reservoir, the biggest reservoir on the bottom, and they would have to replenish that reservoir because every time you pump it up into the upper reservoirs and it sits for a while, it evaporates. The geology of the area is a limestone that's notorious for being leaky, so there would be some loss to evaporation and seepage. So they would have to replace maybe a third of the water needed to fill that reservoir every year, possibly more. That's of concern because the nearest groundwater for that canyon is also the source of springs that come out of the side at the bottom of the Little Colorado River Gorge. At that part of the canyon, it's about 1,500 feet from the bottom to the top, and it gets deeper, 2,000 feet, 3,000 feet deep by the time it gets down to the Grand Canyon. So it's functionally, hydrologically, ecologically, and for the tribes, culturally, a part of the Grand Canyon. So the water that comes out of the springs that would be affected by this groundwater pumping to fill the reservoirs is filled with calcium carbonate. It creates a beautiful aquamarine color. It is warm, and it's much different than the water in the main stem of the Colorado River. And for that reason, there's several fish that are found in the Colorado River system that are endemic only to the Colorado River system. One of those is the humpback chub. And it's prime breeding ground in the Grand Canyon is the Little Colorado River tributary. It's that water that they're adapted to breed in, which are endangered. The Fish and Wildlife Service was moving to downlist that designation to threatened based on the success of reproduction of the humpback chub population in the Little Colorado River. This dam would certainly alter the amount of water coming down the Little Colorado River on a regular basis. It would affect its chemistry. It would affect its temperature. You know, one fisheries biologist said, I couldn't think of a more complete way to destroy the habitat of the chub. So it's a serious threat. Navajo, Hopi, Zuni, 11 affiliated tribes at the Grand Canyon, that entire reach of rivers is very important culturally. There's a traditional salt trail that Hopis have used since time immemorial to access salt in the Grand Canyon. It's listed by the Navajo Nation as being culturally important as a traditional cultural place. So there's cultural impacts, there's endangered fish impacts, and the most important, I think, is that FERC issued permits to this company for two previous applications, which then gives the company 3 years to conduct and prepare a plan to apply for a license without ever consulting with or ever getting the permission of the people that live there. The local chapters, the Navajo chapters all oppose it. The grazing committees oppose it. And so does the Navajo Nation. They just submitted their comments on this. And basically the Navajo Nation says, until we get a government-to-government consultation with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, all action on this permit should stop. So even if after 3 years and they did the feasibility studies and then they applied for a license, that's when FERC says, oh, then you consult the tribes. Well, they're not going to give the permission, so why just go ahead and issue a permit? FERC has the discretion and they have the responsibility. It's a sovereign nation, and this is an outside developer that has come in with a proposal that will never be built under the federal rules. So let's just stop it before it gets started.
That was Roger Clark, Grand Canyon Program Director with the Grand Canyon Trust. Learn more about the campaign to stop new dams from being built on the Little Colorado River Gorge by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFA in Jamestown, New York, KGNU in Boulder, Colorado, KYAQ in Toledo, Oregon, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.